Good evening. You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall here at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, online at cfrc.ca, on Cogeco Cable 282, and streaming on your Android or iPhone apps. This is CFRC Prison Radio. We are a weekly show tackling prison issues here in Canada's prison capital, featuring news, interviews, perspectives, poetry, and more. The last Wednesday of every month, we do a special episode called Calls from Home, where we take your song requests and messages from the friends and family of folks incarcerated in the Kingston area, and we put them out over our airwaves. If you'd like to leave a message or song request for our next episode, which will be on February 28th, please call our voicemail at 613-329-2693. You can email us at cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at CPR Kingston, where you can write us at CPR, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, Kilo 7, Lima 3, November 6. Tonight, we bring you an important interview on an issue we know is close to a lot of the prisoners in this area, prison wages. In 2013, the Conservative government introduced a 30% pay cut to wages for work done by prisoners, called it a food and accommodation tax, and eliminated bonus pay for work done at Corcan facilities. Corcan is a Crown corporation that contracts out prison labor to both the public and private sector and operates several factories in the Kingston area. Prisoners are forced to purchase items such as stamps and personal hygiene products through government-designated suppliers, and wages had already decreased sevenfold in actual purchasing power, as they had not increased since first being established in the early 1980s. After exhausting internal grievance procedures, prisoners here in Kingston at Collins Bay Institution launched a work strike, which spread to federal prisons across Canada. Since 2014, several prisoners were fighting a lawsuit against the Government of Canada, challenging the constitutionality of the pay cuts. At the end of January 2018, a federal court in Ottawa threw out the case, ruling that prison labor falls under programming and that prisoners are not in an employer-employee relationship with the Correctional Service of Canada. I spoke with Jared Shook by phone. He is an ex-prisoner who was a regular contributor when he was inside at Collins Bay here in Kingston. He was a spokesperson for the work strike back in 2013. He was an applicant to the lawsuit in question, and he's now studying criminology at the University of Ottawa, where he continues to be active in prison-related issues. We discussed the history of the inmate pay system, resistance to prison pay cuts inside, the four-year lawsuit process, and the next steps in the struggle for better wages and dignity for prisoner workers. Jared Shook, welcome to the show. Glad to have you back. You've always been a big contributor to CFRC Prison Radio, and we're happy to have you back on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure, as always, to reconnect with you, particularly from the other side of the fence.
Why don't we begin with some history behind this so-called inmate pay system? So would you be able to give our listeners an overview of what exactly the inmate pay system is and where it comes from in correctional history?
Essentially, the rate of pay for prisoners who perform work in institutions that contributes to the operation and maintenance of the prison, as well as productive labor that occurs at Corcan Industries, was compensated officially, as far as I understand, in the 80s, based on a portion of the federal minimum wage at the time. The way that they had calculated it was that a typical Canadian would need to spend a certain percentage of their earnings on food, clothing, accommodation, basic necessities. So they basically did some calculations and figured out that based on that assessment, prisoners would be entitled to, or it would be fair to give prisoners approximately $6.90 a day or so. Actually, I think it was upwards of $7 a day at that time. Through the course of time, they made a few revisions to it. Ultimately, they ended up with a pay scale that ran from the lower end of $5 on way up to $6.90 a day. And your rate of pay was either A-level, B-level, C-level, or D-level. I think there was also an E-level that would be a refusal to work that would entitle you to, I believe, a dollar a day. And the rate that you would be paid for the work that you do in the institution would be also sort of tied to your correctional plan and how well you do the job, and sort of as an incentive, or they would use it as an incentive to encourage people to work and do programs. Since the 80s, obviously, in all economies in Canada and around the world, inflation has occurred. So the purchasing power for prisoners in the 80s versus the purchasing power for prisoners in 2017 has changed. To use the words of the correctional investigator, $8.16, essentially, as far as purchasing power goes, is about equivalent to $60 or so in 2017 in terms of how much purchasing power you would have that with that money. So throughout the course of time, or throughout the passage of time, wages have not increased for prisoners for work that they perform in institutions. And it's a lot more costly for them to buy the things that they need, hygiene items, making telephone calls to loved ones, stamps, other necessities, clothing items, things of that nature.
So just to be clear, you're saying that the costs of the same items that you'd be buying in the 80s have jumped about sevenfold, and the wages have remained the same.
I mean, so the way the correctional investigator termed it is that like a typical what he would call a typical canteen basket. So if you think about like what would be the basic items that a prisoner would buy every 2 weeks when they have the opportunity to go to canteen, we're talking, like I said, hygiene items, maybe a couple cans of tuna, you know, maybe some stamps, maybe some stationery, things of that nature. You know, in the 80s, $8 would provide all of those things, right? And now the same items would cost you about $60, right? So that's sort of where that comes from. But as we got towards 2013, in 2012, actually, most of the listeners might be aware that we had a conservative government at that time who had arrived with a majority government on their third term. And essentially they were elected, I would argue, as a result of their tough on crime agenda, or at least they played that very well politically. And as a part of that agenda, one of the things that was a centerpiece was this idea of what Vic Tays described as inmate accountability. And he said that one of the ways that prisoners needed to be accountable was by paying more for their stay in prison. So they introduced a food and accommodation tax of 30% on the wages that prisoners were earning, which were already, I would argue, paltry. And they also eliminated the $2.20 per hour incentive payments that prisoners received for the productive labor that they did at CORCAN.
Can you explain what CORCAN is and what kind of work the prisoners perform within the framework of CORCAN?
Yeah. So CORCAN is essentially a Crown Special Operating Agency. Prisoners who work at CORCAN essentially, as I said, engage in often productive labor that has included in the past, to my knowledge and experience, contracts with IKEA, assembling couches, doing textiles, sewing, refurbishing buses for the city of Ottawa, manufacturing furniture that you can find in many university libraries and government offices. They also have welding programs there. And, you know, to be fair, it's not entirely centered around productive labor with profit-seeking. I mean, there are also some elements, certainly, that are geared towards training, such as their welding program. And, you know, I do know of some individuals who have received welding tickets that have served them well on the outside. So, I mean, it has a couple of components. Part of it is training, but also productive labor. Interestingly, however, and folks who are listening to this can refer to a National Post article that was published a few months back, Corcan's ability to actually make a profit based on the way it operates has been pretty limited over the years, and essentially it often costs more for them to run the program than they actually make in terms of profits.
But I would presumably, for a company like IKEA to contract Corcan, they must be making some kind of,
of
profit out of that.
Yeah, so if anybody's profiting, it would be the companies who are contracting cheap labor from prisoners, right?
Like a majority of the work done in Corcan facilities, it seems to be a blend of contracts, like cost-saving contracts for the government and some private sector partners that they contract with. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be exactly how I would explain.
And then there's also institutional jobs that fall under this pay system. So these, what kinds of things would prisoners do?
So, I mean, we can speak about this a little later in the conversation, but, you know, one of the things that CSC is arguing, the government's lawyers are arguing, is that there's no employer-employee relationship between the Correctional Service of Canada and prisoners when they perform labor in institutions. The reason being is that these aren't jobs, these are essentially programs. And, I mean, pushing a broom and cleaning floors and cleaning bathrooms, doing plumbing, doing electrical work, grounds work, mowing lawns, shoveling snow, up to and including administrative work in offices, which assist with managers of different departments of the institution, committee work as individuals on prisoner committees do. These are all jobs that happen in the institution. Some people even have jobs as caretakers for other prisoners who might have mobility issues or otherwise in the school as tutors. I mean, so arguably there is a skill set to be acquired in doing some of these jobs, some perhaps more than others. But at the end of the day, it's work, right? And since it's work, arguably, it would fall within the boundaries of the employee-employer relationship, which we attempted to argue. Unsuccessfully.
You wrote a really good piece, I remember, in 2013 called Incentive to Scrutinize, an Account of Accountability, that sort of went through all the ways in which you exhausted the channels, right? Internal channels to try to challenge this announced pay cut.
Within the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, the Correctional Service of Canada is responsible to consult with prisoners on all issues other than security-related matters, so they can have input into decision-making. We could get into that later in our conversation about whether that's a legitimate process, but they did announce that they were going to do this, and they did ask the population for their input. So prisoners in the prison where I was serving time, as well as all across Canada, certainly made submissions outlining the potential negative impacts of this decision. To our knowledge, none of that information was taken into consideration, and in October 2013, the decision was implemented. So, at the institution I was serving time at, in Collins Bay, prisoners actually decided to engage in a work strike, a refusal to work as a way of drawing attention to their grievances. And very shortly after, I think also with the assistance of some coverage from the CBC, it spread across Canada in every region of the country. And that strike lasted approximately 3 weeks. I can't say how it unfolded in every institution, but in the institution where I was serving time, folks were looking for ways that they could get to the table and have a conversation about the policy and see if the key decision makers would at least address some of their concerns. And obviously the goal was to reverse the decision. But ultimately, people wanted to have a conversation and have their grievances heard.
So can you talk a bit about how that work strike happened? Like, how did people actually get together and decide to stop work? And what kind of work stopped? And what effect did that have in the institutions?
I mean, I can't really identify, like, a top-down sort of organizational strategy that I saw unfold in the institution. Right? There seemed like there's just a collective will to address the policy and a sort of spontaneous, well, spontaneous as spontaneous can be when the government announces a decision like they announced, to do what instinctively I think most folks would do, whether in the community or in a prison. Which is use one of the few powers that they have left, which is their right to refuse, right? And so I think it was simply a collective will of the population at that time. I think the unfortunate thing is on the leadership side of things, in terms of, you know, what you might see in the community with, like, a labor union, who might have, you know, several folks who are spokespeople for their group and sort of strategize and lead, is that unfolds a little bit differently in a prison context than it does in the community. Not because, you know, there aren't the same coercive sort of consequences for engaging in such a thing, but the institution, the correctional authorities, have done a fairly good job over the years, I would argue, of dividing the population, and I'm talking even within the institution itself, and disrupting the ability of prisoners to collectively assemble, you know, stand together in solidarity with one another. And some of those reasons, I mean, I could outline now. For instance, Collins Bay Institution. Right, so it's a medium security. Well, now it's a max, medium, and a minimum. But even if we just look at the medium setting itself, right, it's actually situated in a way that you've got people who are all classified in that same medium frame. They all have very different conditions of confinement, and they all might have different things at stake. So, for instance, you know, at that time, 4 Block was open, and 4 Block was known to be the sort of more old school, maybe guys there with what would be perceived to be less to lose, and maybe more willingness to participate in something like that. And then you've got what at the time would have been 6, 7, and 8 Block, which were more like, we would call that the medium of the medium, who may be closer to moving towards something else, maybe have a few more, we'll say, carrots dangling. The sticks chasing them might also matter, but maybe not quite as much. And then you've got 9 Block, which is the sort of lowest responsibility-based living unit in the institution, where people are essentially planning on going from there to parole or to lower security institution. So in terms of having a sort of cohesive group of people who collectively are in the same position and have the same stakes, it's just a very difficult thing to manage. And so as far as maintaining solidarity towards the work strike, I mean, it was just a difficult thing to manage. And, you know, in retrospect, looking back, it's certainly the case that there were probably things that could have been done at that time to see that through further. But I think what we saw unfold in institutions all across Canada is essentially replicated what happened at Collins Bay. And that is that, you know, the loudest people seemed to get the most attention, and it didn't serve them very well. And others saw that, and they saw what the potential consequences might be, and they saw what was at stake. And essentially, they were open, they became open to, you know, these other options of perhaps using what was available within the system. So at a certain point in the strike, people also started looking at other options that would be available. One of those options was simply to send a letter to the Commissioner of Corrections and the then Minister of Public Safety, Stephen Blaney, and essentially say, hey, like, we are concerned about the impacts of this policy and how it's going to affect our ability to save and plan for our eventual release and maintain contact with our family members and purchase basic necessities that we need in the institution. And we're also concerned about how this is going to affect the dynamics of the prison environment that we're serving time in. Those letters were unmet. And prisoners also attempted to seek out waivers of the deduction through another mechanism that's available within the corrections and conditional release regulations, which essentially says that you can, if you can make a case that it would cause you undue hardships, you can request a waiver of the deduction. As far as I understand, no one was entitled to one of those waivers. So we were left with few options at that point due to the dynamic of the prison and essentially decision-making that went on in different institutions amongst different folks. The strike was called off, and individuals started using the internal grievance procedure of the Correctional Service of Canada, which at that time was at three levels. And one of the requirements to get to the federal court is that you exhaust the internal grievance procedure. So folks don't have a lot of faith in that system, but it was a mechanism that we were required to use in order to make it to the federal court for judicial review. So by May 2014, that was accomplished as expected, unfortunately, cynical as we were. The grievances were all denied at that level, and we requested through an application for judicial review that the federal court review the government's decision.
Let's go through that court process a bit. So there was a lawsuit launched, right, against the federal government over the pay cuts.
Yeah.
And that was launched in 2014?
That's right, May.
Okay, and so it's been moving through the courts for about just under 4 years. So what was the process like going through that process of trying to take the government to federal court?
Well, here's the thing. I hate biblical analogies, but let's just call it what it is. The government is Goliath and we were David, right? So, like, they're capable of mobilizing all of the legal resources of the state against us. Meanwhile, we're in a financial position where, one, we don't have enough money anyways, and that's what our argument is. And then we're trying to seek legal counsel to assist us. And, you know, I think the individuals who did step up, such as Todd Sloan, and did essentially all of the work that they did on a pro bono basis, aside from a few hundred dollars here and there that were sent to him from inmate committees, prisoner committees, rather. That's the position that we were in, right? And, you know, to say nothing of whether or not we had adequate legal representation, I think folks did the best they could with the resources that they had. But we're not exactly on par, right? And then even beyond that, I mean, so we're in a position, too, where we're doing affidavits, right? So we had to submit affidavits and, you know, It's a challenging process in and of itself, right? And some of us had to go in the institution and, you know, find out how to draw up a proper affidavit and how to respond appropriately in a legal context to the questions that the government was asking us when we got to that stage. So these are all things that are not, things that are typically at the fingertips of prisoners, even as far as our access to legal resources in our own libraries. You know, it's so dismal, it's so restricted. So we're in a weak position as it was, right? And so the process itself was challenging on that front. And there was a lot of trust and faith put in the individuals who did step up on a pro bono basis to assist us as well. But there's also, you know, across the population of prisoners, I think, given past experiences, quite a lot of apathy and cynicism about that whole process itself. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, the judgment for folks who are able, you know, to read it, I think it unfortunately solidified that cynicism in respect to, you know, utilizing that avenue available within the scope of, you know, the system. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the best way that I could describe it. It took a long, long time as well. I mean, 4 years. I'm not sure if that's typical for a federal request for judicial review, but essentially the case itself was collapsed into several cases across the country from different applicants because we're all seeking to answer the same legal question. And, you know, there was over 8,000 documents, as far as I know, so it was a voluminous file. Even when it was heard last February, it took about a year for the judgment and reasons to be issued, which, you know, erroneously, we had hoped that meant that we were going to get a favorable decision because maybe that was what was taking them so long to respond. But here we are. Do I personally have a renewed sense of faith in that process? I would say no, and I wouldn't say no because I don't think that it can work at all. I would say no in the position that we're in, right, in terms of the legal resources which we had at our disposal and whether or not we went into court on the fairest of terms. I guess my focus personally at this point isn't to dive too far back into the side of addressing the questions that we sought the courts to address legally, whereas I'm moving personally towards a political resolution to the issue at current, although I do think there are still some open questions that were raised, particularly with respect to the consultation process that was used to arrive at this decision, and whether or not prisoners are in fact in an employer relationship with Correctional Services Canada when they carry out work in institutions. And, you know, the more abstract arguments that we made were centered around the purposes of the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, which is supposed to be public safety and rehabilitation, whether or not this decision conforms with that, as well as how the money that prisoners have access to in the institution is actually the means by which they're able to meet what is provided for them protective-wise in the CCRA in terms of reasonable contact with families and health care and clothing entitlements and things like that. But again, the federal court did not see it our way and essentially left us with the statement that they weren't there to decide on the wisdom of the government's decision. I guess where we're left is to engage in a conversation where they wouldn't, which is with the government about the wisdom of their decision right now.
Did the posture of the government's lawyers change at all when the change in government happened with the election of the Trudeau government? Like, have you found there was any more willingness in court from government lawyers to, or were they just basically trying to win the case and defeat the challenge?
I can't say from my vantage point that there was a change in posture or temperament or tone. I know that the government itself did issue a request to the Attorney General to sort of review all the cases that were before the courts and see if it was worth fighting them. And, you know, I thought perhaps when I read that, that, you know, this course or this case might be within the scope of that, and that maybe, you know, folks might have taken a second look at it given the Sunnyways government. But as far as I know, that didn't happen, clearly. And as far as what happened in court and the response between government lawyers and our lawyers and the tone and posture, I never got to see that, really. I guess I suppose I'd have to ask the lawyers that were representing us if that was something that they witnessed throughout the course of it. But I mean, I think at the end of the day, and perhaps I'm wrong in saying this, but the Department of Justice is the Department of Justice is the Department of Justice, right? So, I mean, I guess they appoint different folks at different times and they set the tone, but I'm not entirely certain that, you know, they reshuffle all the lawyers who are there to represent the government when there is a change in government. Perhaps I'm wrong, though.
You're listening to CFRC Prison Radio here on CFRC 101.9 FM. You're hearing an interview that I did with Jared Shook, who is an ex-prisoner and applicant to a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the 30% pay cuts to wages for work done by prisoners that the conservative government did back in 2013. That lawsuit was thrown out of a federal court in January 2018, so we're discussing the history of that, as well as the resistance to the pay cuts inside and the next steps in the struggle for better wages and dignity for prisoner workers. And so I see one of the key reasons that the federal court rejected the challenge was that they, what you said, which is that they do not view the relationship between CORCAN or between CSC and prisoners who are working as an employer-employee relationship. They basically relied on CSC policy that says this is some kind of incentive to participate in programs, and that, yeah, basically it's not a labor relationship. So what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, it starts off with what the pay is, right? So the pay isn't pay; it's incentive to participate in the program. That's the part one, and then the part two is that the work isn't work; that's a program too, because there's some type of therapeutic benefit or downloading of skills that a person wouldn't otherwise have through the course of them doing this job. And I mean, that's all fair and well to say. I won't disagree that an individual can perform any task in the institution and perhaps take away some soft or hard skills. However, that doesn't mean that it's not work, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't, in a significant way, also contribute to the operation and maintenance of the prison. I mean, if you think about it, like, for instance, a person getting up every day, you know, and pushing a broom across the floor and cleaning bathroom toilets and, you know, restocking, you know, cleaning supplies in different areas of the institution, that goes on in government offices every single day. It's work out there. When somebody goes and, you know, performs an electrical job in an institution that otherwise the institution would have to pay a contracted electrician at a government rate at that for a minimum number of hours, I mean, they're deriving a significant benefit there. And, I mean, the person who's doing that electrical work, I'm going to imagine that they would have had to been certified in the community to be able to do that. To me, that's work. I mean, I don't know how far you can classify it otherwise. Productive labor at CORCAN. Certainly, again, I'm not going to disagree that, you know, it's an opportunity to put something on your resume at times, and that, you know, lots of folks that I know that did work at CORCAN enjoyed some of the work that they did and also preferred it much more so to sitting in their cell all day doing nothing. However, it's still work. Right? It's still labor, right? And it's still performed under the supervision and for an authority figure, right? And, I mean, you know, that's just one that I really struggle with understanding. I mean, because practically anything could be called a program in the way that they're defining it, right? They could set up an entire workshop and open up a business right inside the institution and just call it a program, right? And so, you know, where what would be work then? I guess that's the question I have. Like, how could we make the case? Does it just mean that as a result of your having committed a crime, been convicted and sentenced to a term of incarceration, that you could never be afforded the protection of the Canada Labour Code, no matter what the conditions? I guess that's the question I have. And if that is the case, then there's also some dangerous territory in there. And I think the United States is a great example of that, and you need to be concerned. So.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, if you... Is it voluntary to work? And if you choose not to work, what are the consequences for your privileges and parole and these kinds of things?
Yeah, so I mean, people always say this. So, well, it's your choice. I mean, you don't have to work, right? It's voluntary. Certainly it's voluntary in that sense. The coercion comes in. What you've referred to is, you know, restrictions on parole, you know, because all of this is tied to a correctional plan. And your correctional plan is essentially like, you know, the blueprint for where your life is going to go next. And, you know, if you refuse to engage in work or programs, then you're not going to get a transfer to a lower security. You're going to certainly be restricted from accessing even sometimes basic privileges within the institution itself. You're also not going to get access to the very limited amount of resources that CFC will provide to you for the work that you do. So, I mean, yeah, voluntary in one sense, very, very coercive in the other. And, you know, beyond that, it's not like there are very many other options for you too, right? So the option is, you know, sit in your cell all day or in the digger or go push a broom for a few hours. And unfortunately, I think in this case, people are willing to do just that rather than the former.
I see that you you mentioned the United States and sort of some of the dangers of calling anything a program and being exempt from any kind of labor protection. And I noticed also in the decision that he specifically referenced the case where prisoners in British Columbia, I think it was, attempted to form a union called the Confederation Union,
yeah.
And it was shot down. They tried to certify as a legal union, and it was shot down on the same basis that they're not considered employees or in an employer-employee relationship with CSC. So I know in the U.S. there have been basically non-certified unions like the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee established to try to organize as workers, despite the lack of recognition from the state of that relationship. Do you think that is a possible way forward?
Well, yeah. So, if you want to look at it strictly in terms of power, yeah, you don't need any formal recognition from anybody if you're going to be willing to accept as a group the consequences of that decision, which, I mean, we don't know how forceful they might be or how coercive they might be. Then, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there's always power in numbers, right? I don't think anybody would deny that. I think what would be ideal, though, would be that, you know, those associations were officially recognized, so they wouldn't have to, you know, also at the same time bear, you know, this consequence of, you know, being threatened with, you know, not getting a transfer to a lower security institution or, you know, not being able to, you know, have regular contact with the rest of the population in the institution or be released at the earliest possible time that you might be prepared to get back into the community. Because those are big, big things. And even people in the community, you know, even people in the community who put a lot on the line with regard to, you know, going out on work strikes and organizing unions within their workplace, you know, there's always the threat of, you know, retaliation from their employer. But I want people to think about what it's like when liberty is on the line, like liberty, like you're going home or you're staying in prison. That's a really tough thing for a lot of people to decide on. And I wouldn't place a statement on it or a judgment on it either way, whether a prisoner would or would not want to do that, because I think it's a tough place to be in. But, I mean, you know, I think we saw that unfold in 2013, right? And maybe there was a time and a place historically where the culture of the institution even permitted that to a degree, and to use the word permitted is maybe the wrong word, but I think there was a healthy amount of respect on the part of even correctional authorities for a prison population and their collective efforts to address their concerns at certain points in history, whether that was whether it had something to do with their conditions of confinement or work or what it might be. And I think that's the whole reason that prisoner committees were introduced, as a way to have a line of communication between, you know, the population and the administration of the prison, and vice versa. And I think over time, though, that relationship changed for a number of reasons. One being essentially the warden of the institution chooses who can be elected to that position. So if the individual, as well-liked as they might be in the population, is seen to be too much of a threat to the system, or has any blemishes on their record whatsoever, security intelligence officer can essentially say they can't even make it onto the ticket. And even in my own experience as a member of the prisoner committee, you know, it's a tightrope walk on the best of days, right? Because you have to sort of balance off not getting shot off the tightrope by the warden by going too hard, but also not getting shot off the tightrope, you know, by the people that you're there to represent by being, you know, too much of a working for the man or something like that, right? And it's a tightrope walk. It's not an easy position to be in today. You know, I wasn't there in the 70s or the 80s or even, you know, the 90s, but I know things are very different today than they were. And I don't think there's one prisoner who would serve time that won't say that. And there's, you know, plenty of explanation as to why that is so. I mean, prisoners have less power today than they used to have. That's a fact.
So in terms of next steps, do you think this will go to the Supreme Court? Or you've also mentioned a political strategy. Where do you see this heading?
Well, I personally can't really make too many comments about what other folks are thinking, meaning other folks on the file, applicants on the file, in terms of appealing to the Supreme Court. I don't know, based on my reading of the judgment and my very limited ability to read legalese, I don't know whether that is the best next step or not. So I can't see otherwise. I personally am not looking at that as an option for myself at this moment. As of right now, today, I'm investing my time and resources into seeking a political resolution, because I think there is space right now, more than any other time, at least in the last 10 to 12 years, to at least, at the very least, have the decision reversed and have the incentive pay reintroduced, if not to also open up a serious conversation about whether prisoners should be paid more than what they're currently being paid, and what work should really look like inside an institution. So I want to be a part of that conversation. I want one thing also is I want this consultation process, like that's something I've actually been trying to highlight all along, but it doesn't seem to be getting as much attention. I think the consultation process is superficial. I think that, like, there are many different stakeholders, if you want to call them that, in the issue, beyond just prisoners, people in the community who should be at the table at those discussions. And it seems like CSC and the government just has a whole lot of authority to introduce whatever decision they want, despite what even those with, you know, some very reasonable concerns have to say. And I think there needs to be some at least accountability for how that information is taken into consideration when they make a decision. So that's sort of where I'm investing my energy now, but we'll see where that goes and we'll see what happens next, right? I've spoken with the policy advisor for the the Minister of Public Safety of late, after I'd written an op-ed in the Ottawa Citizen and done some media work with the CBC highlighting where we're at following that decision. I'm supposed to meet with them towards the end of the month, and I've also got an opportunity to engage with some members of the Public Safety Office towards the middle of the month. So I'm going to see what the response is, and I'm going to sort of evaluate that personally and see, you know, whether that route is worth continuing to pursue. But at the end of the day, like, I've said this before, like, I will also, my constituents, if you will, are prisoners. I came out here, I'm doing this work for prisoners, right? And, you know, a social movement or action for prisoners without other prisoners is not action or a social movement at all. So I don't want to come out here and claim to be, like, you know, the unilateral spokesperson. You know, if prisoners themselves want to, you know, find different ways and means of addressing the issue, or they have concerns about this sort of political approach, I'd like to hear about them. But in my recent work with the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons, one of the main things that was highlighted to us, because we did reach out to prisoners across the country in every region at every security level, and we asked them straight up, what are your top 10 concerns? The government is saying that they're going to review all of the laws, policies, and practices that were brought in under Harper, and it looks like there's some space for change. We're concerned with reforms, but we think that if there's things that can happen right now in the short term, that they're worth, you know, at least bringing to the table. And what type of social action would you like to see people out in the community engage in to assist? And we got back over 50 responses. We published a 300-page journal, and that's now in the hands of these, you know, decision makers and whatnot. But I mean, here's a statement from one individual. His name is Trevor Bell, and he wrote to us from Mission Institution out on the West Coast, and he says, the contextual basis of the argument is that the process of deducting money from prisoners' pay is in direct contravention of both the purpose and principles contained within the Corrections and Conditional Release Act. CFC's mandate is to support our rehabilitation and reintegration into the community. That is simply not possible when an individual now has to choose between calling his community support network, buying deodorant, sending a card to his daughter, or going hungry in the evening for 2 hours or 2 weeks. The aforementioned choices are not something any human being in this country should have to make. And then he essentially goes on to say a comprehensive review of the federal penitentiary system pay scale needs to be undertaken with an eye on affecting an increase to the overall remuneration offered to prisoners. And then he outlines, you know, what he thinks would be, you know, fair even given the circumstances. And there are plenty of submissions from prisoners making just these points. So I have to accept that personally as the will of some folks, right? And so these are the issues that I'm trying to bring as somebody who's lucky enough to be on the other side of the fence and out here and can engage with these people and share these voices and perspectives. So, I mean, if anything, I'm just an intermediary to it all. I've got some of my own perspectives and positions and opinions on things, but essentially my read on things is that this is what people want at this point, and I'm just trying to see it through. So,
have you had any contact with any labor unions or any, like, the Fight for 15 people? I'm just thinking in the context of Ontario raising its minimum wage eventually to get to $15 an hour. Like, do you see any support from that sector? Like, why not extend that? Just an idea, but just why not extend that struggle into the prison, you know?
You know, it's funny you mention that because a lot of people actually did, like, the people who are commenting on stories and things that have come out over the last while and Facebook posts that we've been making and stuff like that. A lot of the people on the left, anyways, the people on the right are saying that they should introduce the Phoenix pay system and show prisoners what's up. But that's another conversation. People on the left, though, seem to be saying exactly that, right? Like, you know, drawing reference to what's happening in Ontario with the federal or the new $15 minimum wage, and, you know, linking that to the idea that prisoners should also be compensated in some fair way for the work that they do in institutions. And, you know, at the university where I'm studying right now, There are also a lot of individuals who have been paying attention to this issue. Jordan House at York University in Toronto essentially is doing his PhD work. I think he's actually coming near completion on Corcan. And I think he's got some interesting perspectives on things as well. The Postal Workers Union, CUPW, here in Ottawa, I've had some off-the-record conversations with some individuals, and their perspective is interesting too. So, yeah, I think that I think it's a good idea, and I think it's interesting because, you know, CSC's Guards Union, you know, is so powerful and so strong in the sense that they're essentially able to get whatever they ask for when they go to the table. If you look at any of their most recently negotiated contracts. But, I mean, if you think about the history of labor movements in Canada and labor unions and how they're so often typically associated with sort of, you know, left-wing, I don't want to say ideology, but philosophy, I'd be interested even to hear, like, what do they think about this, right? Like, how does that square up with labor rights, labor unions? You know, I don't think they would be in a position, arguably, to discredit the idea that prisoners themselves should have some labor rights. And in fact, I would argue that prisoners having some labor power rights and being paid in a fair wage is actually in their best interest, despite the fact that they'll never admit it. But that's another conversation.
Is there anything you want to say to people listening to the show on the inside about, I don't know, advice from your own experience trying to organize inside, what you think people can do, or anything you just want to say generally?
Any individual serving time in a prison, whatever security level, whatever region of the country, whether you're a man or woman, like, we've been stripped of a lot, right? They take your clothes, they take your personal belongings, they rip you out of whatever community that you were formerly a part of, and they place you in this space where you now occupy a very different social position in life. They don't take your heart and your mind from you at the end of the day. And, you know, folks can make decisions to do what they would like to address this issue. I think that our efforts were appropriate in 2013. But, like, whenever you are in a position where you find something to be incompatible with what you see as being correct or appropriate, I mean, you have an option to voice that, right? Or find a way to acknowledge that in the community that you're a part of, whether it's a prison or whether it's out here. And they never take that from you, right? I think I tried to draw attention to that through a poem that I'd written, you know, a while back. You know, I said, even though it's sort of gendered terminology, what's left in the mirror is the man or woman you confront. So what will it be? Are you happy to be another category? What they expect, or would you rather have some self-respect? If you have a voice, you have a choice. And I'm not saying just making some noise. There's enough of that already. What I mean is use your head, see, and creativity. And even though you will face opposition, your opponents will be forced to respect a well-thought-out position. And yes, there will be haters. There always are. It's a sign of success. It's kind of a test. They matter the less, the more you weather the storm and absolutely refusing to conform. You know, and so we all have a choice, right? And if you believe in something, you believe in, see it through. But, you know, be thoughtful, you know? Like, we have to be thoughtful in our decision-making. And that's really all I would leave people with.
Any links or anything you want to share with folks who want to find out more or how they can get involved or support this?
Folks know, because we've sent plenty of correspondence into the institutions, about the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons. So anybody wants to bring anything to attention of the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons, please write to us. We're always interested in working with authors in prison to bring their ideas to the table and like allow the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons to be a forum. And even if it's just simply to update us on, you know, new things that are happening in institutions. And, you know, they could even do that through, you know, the radio show as well, and you guys can forward it on to us. And, yeah, I would say that would be the best route right now. The website for that is also www.jpp.org, so for folks who are able to go to the library and the institution where they're serving time, and the librarian will do, you know, a Google search or whatever, check out the website, and they can see sort of what the submission guidelines are, how to send things in, and get some information about the latest issue. But also, you know, if somebody has a perspective and they've got some writing skills, write an op-ed for whatever newspaper is in the community that you're a part of. Like, circulate the ideas in the community. Share them with people, document your experiences. You know, it's really important that people know, because there's so much misinformation out here. And, you know, we need to sort of challenge the hegemony of punishment and finality. And I think, you know, it's something we need to keep chipping away at. So.
Well, Jared, thanks a lot, as always, for coming on the show. Appreciate your perspective a lot. And good luck with these next steps. We'll be there with you.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black for those who've never read or listened to the words that Jesus said about the road to happiness through love and charity. Why, you think he's talking straight to you and me? Well, we're doing mighty fine, I do suppose, in our streak of lightning cars and fancy clothes. But just so we're reminded of the ones who are held back, up front there ought to be a man in black. I wear it for the sick and lonely old, for the reckless ones whose bad trip left them cold. I wear the black in mourning for the lives that could have been. Each week we lose 100 fine young men. And I wear it for the thousands who have died, believing that the Lord was on their side. I wear it for another 100,000 who have died, believing that we all were on their side. Well, there's things that never will be right, I know, and things need changing everywhere you go. But till we start to make a move to make a few things right, you'll never see me wear a suit of white. Oh, I'd love to wear a rainbow every day and tell the world that everything's okay. But I'll try to carry off a little darkness on my back till things are brighter. I'm the man in black.